This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Quality. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hi,
welcome to another of our great PaizoCon seminars, or at least we hope it is. This one's a little experimental. This seminar is called Find Our Path, and to be honest, when I pitched this, I was like, yeah, that'll never make it on the schedule, and then it just appeared. So welcome. This seminar is really kind of here just to kind of... For those of you who have been to our other seminars, who have gotten a chance to play the new version of Pathfinder, this seminar is really kind of here just to kind of talk about what we're doing, what you think we could do, what things would be great in a new version of Pathfinder. What we're releasing in August is a playtest version of the game. It's not the final. It's not... Nothing in it is set in stone. A lot of things will feel that way. You'll be like, oh, well, they put all this work into it, so surely they're just going to put it out no matter what we say. That's not true. That's really not true. This team prides itself in looking at rules material and going, wow, we spent a lot of time on that. Too bad it needs to go in the dumpster.
That's definitely true.
Because
is that how it medium?
Yeah. Your 50,000-word class. So we pride ourselves in our ability to be very critical of our own work. And this seminar is really kind of here, it's almost purely Q&A. So I want you guys to start getting ready, because we're going to want you guys to talk to us about first edition, what worked for you, what didn't work for you, kind of what elements you are really hoping we change, what elements you're really hoping we don't change. This is kind of a weird feedback form. The game's already gone to the printer, but just the playtest. So this is kind of our first official kind of like, so we've showed you a bunch of stuff. What things are you kind of disappointed that we didn't do? What things are you excited that we did? What things are you hoping we do? What's your hopes and dreams for the next year? That's kind of what I'm gonna want to ask. And this is almost entirely a back and forth kind of thing.
So, Jason, I have a question first.
Sure.
Because I don't know the answer to this. What separates this from the Monday panel that is also about
so feedback? The Monday panel is specifically focused on people's experience with things that they have played. This is more about pie in the sky. You guys don't know half of what's going into the game. You know, just kind of if you were us, what would you do? Help us find our path.
We have an eager hand.
Yeah. God. So I'll get to that in just a sec. First, I want to let the entire panel introduce themselves. I'm Jason Bowman. I'm the director of game design at Paizo.
I'm Logan Bonner. I'm a designer on the design team.
I'm Mark Seifter. I'm a designer on the design team.
Oh, I'm Stephen Randy McFarland. I'm the senior designer. I don't have a
got
tag
a beer.
They lost it. They stole it. They were all like, that guy's got a long name.
you traded it for beer. We know
what
happened.
Is that your
Oh, no, this came from a freelancer.
Oh. Somebody's getting some work.
Yeah.
I know a whole bunch of people who aren't getting work. All the people who didn't buy me beer.
All right. Now, I think what we're going to do is we're just going to open this up here in relatively short order. I want to say that, you know, one of our, just from a philosophical standpoint, when we approach this process, the one thing that we wanted to do above all else was make sure that the game itself, the narrative, the structure, the feel of the game, the feel of the world that the game represents didn't change. Right? We weren't approaching this like, well, screw it. Goodbye, you know, wizards. We're done with them. There aren't any of those anymore.
Arcane magic doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, and it's now set in, you know, 16th century France.
We like fantasy better.
That's right, yeah.
Black mages we have.
Yeah. We're moving it further earlier in the timeline. Now everyone fights with crude stone clubs. That's it. That's what you have. What's your feat? Bash. Simple game now.
We're continuing with the characters who went to Russia in Reign of Winter and just going from there.
Yeah, yeah. You're now stuck in World War II. Enjoy. Okay, so without further ado, I think we're just going to let you guys talk, and then we're going to kind of speak about some of the things that we did around that kind of stuff. You were super eager, so you get to go first.
Yeah. Okay, this is something I've wanted to, like, pull someone aside and just, like, speak into their ear. No. Just be like, please bring this to the forum at some point. So I am a short, wide, redheaded woman of Scottish and Germanic ancestry, and so that's I have a very deep love of dwarves. That's basically, like, there you go, that's basically everything that, like, Tolkien and Watsi back in the day pulled for their idea of, like, what they're gonna build the dwarves to do. And I've always thought that dwarves need the Paizo treatment. Like, you guys picked up goblins and you made them your own. You picked up, like, so many different races, and you gnomes. Like, my god, gnomes used to be, like, okay, they're the tinkerer halflings. So goddamn boring. No, really. Like, you guys took it and you
made it. All you gnome fans?
They're interesting. They're unique. Right. They're something that you don't read something somewhere else and go, oh, that's just like a gnome anywhere. You read this and you go, no, this is a Paizo gnome. I've always thought you guys need a deeper delve on dwarves.
Well, it's weird because James Jacobs loves dwarves.
So funny you should mention that, actually. So interestingly enough, I love dwarves too.
Yeah.
And in the very early days of Paizo, shortly after we lost, or the magazines ended, and we were kind of looking, you know, like, what do we do? And we started building our world. Eric and James seriously entertained a conversation that was like, maybe we should just cut dwarves from the game. And I'm like, shut up. We're not doing that.
Yeah.
So I think dwarves have always been an integral part of our world and our game, but you're right, they do need more.
Yeah.
And we've done a little bit with them now with the new edition of the game. So one of the things that we had happen is in the very early stages of this, and I'm talking like last year in spring, we had Wayne Reynolds come out to the office for about
winter.
Oh, was it winter? It was the winter before? It was even forever ago. The last year and a half's been a blur. So we had him come out for like, oh, it must have been a couple weeks.
It was like nearly a couple months.
Yeah, he was out for a while, and he'd come into the office every day, and he'd just do sketches for us. And I mean, Wayne's an amazing artist, so just to be able to be like, Wayne, I would like a drawing of halfling helmets.
Yeah.
And he'd just like, yeah, we'll get right on. We're not recording this, so I can do my terrible Liverpool. Ah, no! Wayne, don't listen to this. I'm sorry, my impersonation of you is terrible.
I played half of my own game. He doesn't realize that yet. He thinks it's all.
Yeah, no. So he would just go and draw these amazing things. So one of the things that we wanted him to look at very closely was dwarves, because we wanted them to be a little bit more recognizable as us. We wanted us to pick a direction with their look and their expression and go with it. And he started sketching out all of these dwarves, and he kind of played around with some of their facial features and made them a bit more broad-faced, and he started giving us armor designs and stuff, where if you put a whole bunch of dwarves in this armor, I'm not sure we've released the image of it yet.
Well, we released the image of the dwarven weapons that have, like, the bearded dwarf
as sure.
The axe.
Well, one of the things is, like, this armor that looks like jagged mountain peaks, so if you have a whole bunch of dwarves standing side by side, they look like a mountain range, and it's awesome. And one of the things he started doing is he put all of these ceremonial crystal hilted daggers at all of their sides, and we were just like, why are you doing that? And he's just like, well, I figured it'd be a clan symbol, you know, a symbol of your clan. You're given one at birth, and we started playing around with it, and I like the concept that when a dwarf is born, they craft this dagger before the dwarf is born. And after it is born, they use it to cut the umbilical cord, and that is the first dagger that tasted your blood, and you carry it your entire life and are buried with it.
That's
awesome!
Right?
Yeah.
So we've gotten as far as when they're... We've gotten as far as right after they're born. Now the rest of the stuff is what we still need to fill in.
May I toss, like, two suggestions that I thought of that... Like, okay, so number one for Scottish and Germanic peoples, like, okay, so dwarves have that negative to charisma, and so you don't have anything about dwarven bards. Like the cultures that people generally draw on for dwarves, bards actually have a big role because there's this whole background of like the Norse sagas and this oral history. And it definitely makes sense for dwarves because they're a race that was completely created underground. They were birthed underground. And so like having more language-based stuff, because it seems to me like they'd be a very language-based people coming from a place where like vision does not matter as much.
Yeah.
And
certainly less colorful artwork.
Exactly. and like the second thing, it actually ties into that as well, as like a race that was purely birthed below ground. You'd think that mechanically that would also perhaps enhance a lot of like their magic. Like maybe their writing that has like a sensory feel to it, kind of like Braille. And that's why runes are so distinctive, so that you can like run your hands down it and read it.
Like, I like how a lot of them are made so that they're easy to carve.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're going to put them in stone, you don't want a bunch of curves.
Yeah. Not only that, like that also gives you a reason why they might be more of a language, historical race. Because when you're traveling above, you know, to above ground, that was their whole journey. Like, why are you carrying all these stone tablets with all the information on it? You're not going to bring your deeds and things with you.
Yeah.
You're gonna bring the most important stuff. You're going to leave the rest behind, and you're probably going to be basing yourself on an oral tradition to a certain extent. And so I imagine, weirdly enough for dwarves, sorcerers would probably be more common than wizards, because wizards are so based on...
Well, reading a spellbook's going to be hard, that's for sure.
Or wizards are going to be so different, because dwarves are also close to the elements.
Sure.
So...
There's certainly some interesting opportunities. One of the things that we've built into the rules now are these ancestry feats that allow you to kind of take the class or the character in different directions. So I think there is some opportunities there to play around with some of that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
All right, let's move on.
Okay, so an iconic situation is, let's say, an adventuring party goes up against one big bad, whether it's a dragon, a lich, big wizard, etc., etc. But the problem with running that, at least the first edition, is the action economy on, you know, everybody going and then they go. And is there any look into that? Maybe like they get additional turns or something weird, because you guys kind of did that in Mythic, I believe.
We did.
Mythic had the Mythic Agile template and a few other ways to get extra actions. Mm-hmm. We have found so far in the playtest, and we hope you guys will test it and see what you find, that the one big enemy works a little bit better even without extra turns than it did before due to critical successes and critical failures. It can often pull off critical successes against the PC's saving throws and make the PCs critically fail against it or critically succeed on attack rolls because of its higher bonus. So that inherently helps.
Yeah, and the damage and the hit points tend to scale up a little greater from level to level, so they're also going to be putting out more damage per action. And being able to have more flexible kind of attack routines.
Yeah. And more flexible that's reactions as well, right? So a lot of those big bad guys have sort of like, haha, you thought this, but watch this reaction, kid.
Well, and in some cases, we also designed some of the monsters to work better as a solo encounter, right? So when you go to fight a Hydra, you don't necessarily fight seven Hydras. You fight one Hydra. But one Hydra, you know. Yeah, no, I cannot. Well, actually, now I can. That's the thing. Now I can. Because we kind of changed how they function. It isn't like spend an action to bite with one head. They can do that. But they also have special abilities that are like, oh, I'm going to spend, I think it's two or three of my actions, and bite everyone within reach. Or I'm going to focus on one guy purely, and I'm just going to take all my bites on him with a special ability that allows me to even deal damage even if I roll poorly, right? So some of that's just us being smarter with the game design space and identifying that there are some monsters that are designed to be monsters you only fight by themselves, and they have abilities to help mitigate the fact that they're losing the action race.
I'd still put a few chunks in there to help out your boss, just to make the encounter a little more dynamic and a little less swingy. But you absolutely can. And rather, in first edition, if you did that, it would be like, well, the PCs kill it. In
possibly playtest, immediately.
Possibly immediately. In the playtest, it's a little more swingy. Like, the PCs might have a really good fight. They might take them out early with a unlucky nat one for the boss, but they might actually be on the ropes because of the more powerful numbers that the boss can bring to bear with the critical success and failure. So it's a little more swingy, but it's a little more functional.
Sweet.
Go behind the ring riff.
I really like the design space around the action economy. So yeah. I just ask that you heavily consider adapting and expanding the words of power.
So, funny enough, words of power, boy. That I designed that system a long time ago, and I am always amazed by the number of people who really love it. And then everybody else is like, meh. Yeah, it's interesting. I think there's probably a better opportunity for it now than there was in the previous system. It never really quite worked the way I wanted it to. It was close, but... Yeah. Anybody else here? Any experience with words of power? Anybody love it? Who all loves it? Who hates it? You can be honest. You're hurting my feelings. Yeah, I know you hate it.
I thought it's in between.
Yeah, no, all right. That's about even...
Who's indifferent?
So it's like 90% of the people don't care. All right, yeah. So...
How many of us don't care because we never used it because it's a page of reading?
Well, it's a lot more than that. It was like a whole chapter.
Right. Yeah. I feel like, though, that you could use the different casting actions as part of the words of power.
Yeah.
Like, this is a different word.
Well, and it's funny because this...
Well, and we have, like, Magic Missile and Heal as kind of examples of...
And this kind of speaks to how this process works over time, right? So... This system came out years ago. We never really did much with it. We kind of played around with it. We thought about maybe other ways we could use it, and it just kind of went fallow. But that said, some of that DNA still made it all the way up to the new edition of the game. I mean, the way that we construct spells out of actions, I wouldn't say it was directly influenced by that, but we could definitely see the parallels and go, oh, this is similar to that in some way.
I would say Meta Magic particularly works a little bit like some of those words of power.
As a matter of fact,
the words.
Yeah, that they're almost the exact same thing, right? It's like, oh, just add another action onto this and you get... some other effect. So that's very similar in the way that those things are
implemented. I also think Words of Power would have a little stronger place if we kind of had, like, here is a class that is dedicated to this, right?
Yeah.
And had something that's really thematic to the world and really gets people excited about it. Because if you have something that kind of feels like a disconnected system, it can be harder to get buy-in. But if you have, like, oh, here's the character I want to build that uses this, it's a lot easier to kind of see a tangible thing that you want to bring into a game.
Yeah. Ringwraith.
Okay, two things that I would really love to see real quick. First is, I would love to see every element have unique special effects. Fire consistently sets people on fire, but it's consistent, you get the idea. Second thing that I would really love to see is for every school of magic to have some viable offensive type.
You know,
I don't quite agree with the second one. The first one we've certainly done some of, and you can see that in, like, the flaming property and some of that kind of stuff. Though not every spell does something like that. For example,
we found that in playtest, we'd add a fireball. And it used to be, if it's a critical fail, you also get lit on fire.
Yeah.
And it was turned out to just slow it down too much to calculate all those different people who got set on fire.
We certainly have some that are like, this is a typical effect for this particular quality, but less. We haven't done it globally just because of some of those tricky parts.
It does speak to an interesting kind of facet of rebuilding some of these rules elements, is that you can look at a thing and go, yeah, this is a really smart idea. I mean, obviously we'd do that, right? You know, obviously we'd add slowing effects to the lightning because it makes you all jittery. Oh, obviously we'd add continuous burning effects to the acid. And you can play around with those things, but it does get to the point where you're hitting people with area of effects, and all of a sudden everybody has seven conditions they have to start tracking. And it just becomes too much. That said, finding flavorful ways to make that stuff expressive of what it is kind of half the fun.
Doing more of that on the monster side as well. Like, more monsters that are weak to certain things or have a special effect. Like, if you're attacking a scarecrow, fire's going to set it on fire and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We don't have a scarecrow written up, but I assume we would do that.
Yeah, I mean, as for making sure that there's more viable offensive options for all the schools, yes and no. I think certain schools need to serve their function.
The deal breaker for me is abjuration.
Oh,
like, I just don't feel like
I protect her. You. hold spells.
Person.
Yeah.
Hold
on. I think those are an enchantment right now.
Well, I'm just saying that is consistent with what we're abjuration.
Sure. Yeah, no, I think there's some routes through that, but I think. A thing that we also did is that we made the coding of, like, you have to live only in one school is significantly less in this version of the game. Like, being a specialist wizard doesn't lock off parts of the spell list to you anymore. You just get bonuses with the part that you're really good at.
And we kind of trying to, and we talked about this in the other panel before this, like, remake some illusion spells that so that they to really give a personality that's different in the way that you affect the fight for each of the eight schools, but not all of them are offense.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's more based on buffs or playing defense and using some of your other schools to go into the offense, because there's a whole lot to the game and magic intersects with all of it, and it's not always all about damage or taking somebody out of the fight.
Yeah, sometimes conditional effects can be just as good. But that said, it's still a very valid point that if you want to be able to play that type of character and you want to kind of stick to one thing, you have to make sure that that character feels like they're a valuable part of contributing to every situation. Let's go way over here.
So on the subject of magic, actually, so in the... I attended a previous talk about playtest, and there have been articles online. So arcane and divine magic are still facets of this world. My curiosity, though, is about psychic magic and occult-related things, whether or not that is not necessarily something that's going to, like, have its own major branch right away, but I'm wondering if it's the sort of thing that will be more quickly incorporated since it's now a big part of
the they're still in the world.
Yeah,
we do have a skill called occultism that we've talked about before, so that at least you can know about it.
And occultism, we've also kind of taken some of, like, the aberrations tend to be things that you would identify with occultism, and there are kind of some things in the world that were in other spots that we felt were more suitable to occultism and have kind of moved into that territory.
Yeah, I think the important thing to note about a process like this, and one of the biggest challenges, I wouldn't say challenges, one of the biggest opportunities we had, was that, you know, we've been working on the game for 10 years, building all these additional systems, and a new start like this gives us a chance to integrate everything from the start. That's a big perk. But it also is really challenging, because there's an awful lot of pieces, and we have to decide what goes in when and how those things all fit together. But laying the groundwork now makes it all easier as we go forward.
Yeah, another thing that kind of made it into the core is the occultist's concept of resonance made it into magic items as kind of a more baseline thing. Like, this is true of items, and then we have that foundation when the occultist comes along and we can
build up. It all started with the iron stones and resonance on the wayfinders.
Yeah.
That found its way into the occultist because we talked to people from the world about what's going on with these Aslanti things, how did it come up to be that way, and then that has now moved on from those books into more of a broader area.
Yeah.
Couple things about first edition I would like to see change. One is a way to easily have monsters stay relevant for more levels. I feel like now, once you're kind of like two CRs below the party, it's often kind of a mop up. And for humanoids that can take class levels, it's pretty easy, although sometimes time consuming to fix. I would love to see just kind of an easier monster scaling if you want to have a campaign that focuses around a single type.
Yeah.
The other thing, and this is actually kind of based on what you said about the swinginess, I'm just curious, I think, you know, it once in double digits, it's not uncommon to have combats that last, say, take only three rounds but could take over an hour.
Sure.
And I wonder if the goal is to shoot more for, still have these short, intense combats, but maybe shorten the amount of real time that they take, or is it to still have hour-long combats but maybe have them play out over 8 or 10 rounds, or...
Yeah, I think they are still going to get longer in general. There are some kind of factors that I think are going to make it not as big of a gulf. One of those is that the action economy is going to help some, and we don't have as many things that don't take actions or that are, you know, you're combining, you know, a swift action and an immediate action and three free actions to kind of make a thing happen. We're kind of trying to make that more straightforward. So instead of saying, well, I can do these eight things, I'm going to do all eight things, you say, well, I can do three things, and maybe tack something else on there, so I'm going to have to pick the things that are really important to me rather than just kind of doing everything. I think that's going to help as well.
in terms of monsters scaling, it should be, and obviously in the playtest, as we mentioned before, we're looking towards having used the monsters we made so that we can see if they're good or not for the first bestiary, but we have a much easier way to do monster scaling. If you want a bigger, better version of that monster, if you want to give them some things that are associated with classes, I have some ideas for that that I think would actually be really easy to use on your monsters that we can get into significantly later from now, but it should work well.
Yeah. And we also have, because we, in some of our internal playtests, the higher level fights, they went relatively smoothly. I think we didn't have characters that had been built organically, which once you do that, then it's like, well, I've got these weird five magic items that maybe I'm using some of those, maybe some of those are more complicated. But generally, the fights were fairly smooth at the higher levels.
It is always impressive to me how quickly the player turns go. Like, you have three things you can do. It's not three things with 14 addendums. It's just
right.
Three things.
And you don't have to say, things. Wait, is that a full action, or was that a standard action?
Yeah, and oh, can I tank that? Because, oh no, I took a 5-foot step, so I can't.
As a free action, my other double barrel pistol comes out of my glove of storing, and I shoot it 8 times.
Oh, really? That's the example you're going to go with, Mark. All right.
How many uses did I have left of this magic item? I think I had 2, but I don't remember if I marked one off last time.
Yeah. All right, all the way in the back.
With the new edition, I feel like there's a big vacuum. Because you had all this like intellectual property, right? They're not in the edition. So like the cold measures, it makes me think it's like losing friends. You know, you no longer can make a sidekick or how, what is the cadence, do you think, on the release of stuff like that to fill those voids?
Yeah, I mean, so
I think we're still kind of talking about that.
Yeah, we're still trying to kind of figure that out, to be honest. I mean, what do you think it should
Let's
be?
Let's make sure the system that we're playtesting works fine first before we figure out
what. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I get that, but I think it's interesting because you are right that a lot of people are viewing this as like
a loss.
Oh my God, I don't get to play these, I mean, let's be honest, 30 other classes because we don't have rules for them yet. But at the same token, I want to be able to put out a game that isn't just watch me reprint everything I did for the previous 10 years. So it's a tricky question. There isn't a really good answer. Like, we want to put things out. We want to put out things at a reasonable clip. But to be honest, I don't know that there's any answer that's going to make everyone happy that is short of, here is the book with the other 30 classes in it, which is something we just can't do.
There are also a few classes where you can kind of have a halfway version early on. So like the War Priest, for example, because the cleric has cleric class feats and some of the ways multi-classing works, you can make a War Priest-ish character. And because of the way spellcasting works, you can make a War Priest-ish character or a Magus-y character decently out of the main book.
Right, you essentially have spell combat without needing spell combat.
Yeah, yeah,
and end up built basically a Magus.
Yeah,
and a lot of those we're going to want to do the full one eventually, but the concepts.
You have to cobble with gum, basically.
Well, but
it's
but
really
not,
good gum though.
But not kind of not even really all that much, right? I mean, the system actually really supports it really well. Some concepts, others not so much. But I think if you look at say. So, Insider Baseball, the classes from the Advanced Class Guide originally started out as a concept called hybrid classes. And I think if you took part in the playtest, that's what we called them then.
Yeah.
And the entire point then was like, we took two classes and kind of synthesized them into one. We weren't really necessarily aiming to make a brand new class. We were aiming to make something that was a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. Arguably, some of those classes you could do entirely different ways, so some of them might not make it back into the game as full classes, right? There might be other ways to do them because the rules give us opportunities to say, you love that concept, that's great. Here's the better way to do it. Instead of making an entirely different class, just take this class and take these things and you're basically there. There's no need for me to make something entirely different. And in some cases, some of those you can do right out the gate. Magus is the obvious example. You can literally build
even
a Magus.
Bloodrager, I'm pretty sure you should be able to build a
Bloodrager. Yeah, you're pretty close.
Very easily.
Yeah, probably not out of the playtest rulebook.
Not out of the playtest rulebook because of a very small side reason.
Yeah.
Son of So, but yeah, good points. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is, right? I really don't. There isn't a good answer that's going to make everybody happy.
I feel like we didn't give so much time to people.
Yeah. I mean, I feel you on that. I really do. It's like the things that came toward the end, it's like, the shifter.
Yeah.
Hey guys, I'm here. Oh, the edition's changing. Bye. Right.
I mean, shift.
Yeah. And I'm guessing the occult classes, or we don't know if we're going to put them all out at once, if we're going to do them in stages, or how we're going to construct some of those books. But I expect at least some of that will appear earlier than it did in the previous edition, especially with some of the other concepts that can wait because they're a little easier to kind of cobble together.
And since we have the occultism skill, we can probably get you some kind of occult class sooner than before.
Yeah.
Over here.
So one of the classes that I know that's not in the playtest is the Summoner. And I remember that when it was first introduced, it was more of a mix and match your Eidolon kind of thing with different, you know, you could effectively have like multiple creature types.
How many butts was it?
The 8 butts?
Yeah. 8 butts.
the thing with 8 butts, yeah.
Then when the Unchained Summoner came out, it focused on specific creatures in Galarian.
Down to 1 butt.
Yeah, down to 1 butt. So one of the things I know when you guys get around to it, I would like to see is like what would a summoner look like from the Mwangi Expanse, or what would a summoner look like in tribes in, you know, Arcadia. But compared to, say, how a summoning spell would work in the playtest, how would you imagine that going in regards to what your ideas of
Yeah, one of the big things we have going with like some of the kind of like mounts and that kind of stuff is you giving your actions to another creature in order to command it or control it or whatever. I expect the Summoner would be doing a fair amount of that. That would be like my first.
I don't feel like the way the summon spell works in the playtest.
No, that wouldn't work for the class.
No, and it wouldn't really tell us what would be different about a Summoner in the Mwangi Expanse versus. In different countries in Galarian. That's something we want to work closely with the world team to figure out what their vision
is. And also the Summoner is kind of, I have my Eidolon, and the summon spell is, I have a badger. And those are very different things, both conceptually and practically.
Yeah, it's funny. The Summoner was... the initial concept was, so you want to play the monster. Cool. The monster was always the focus, and the character controlling the monster was supposed to be the monster's Achilles heel, right? Take out that guy, and the monster goes away, right? That was the initial concept for the class, and I'm not sure that the implementation ever kind of fully realized that. I think the class ended up too, the guy, the Achilles heel ended up being too good. But it didn't felt really satisfying for the play experience to be like, well, this is my character and he sucks, but the monster he summons is awesome.
Great friend.
Way in the back corner.
Economy. Are we doing anything different with money in this edition in Tackle like no other role-playing game ever has? Because inevitably, you know, player characters come to town, they've got thousands and thousands of gold pieces. Trying to spend it, you know, I mean, realistically, we all know that would actually happen, but I'd like to, you know, really see something different happen for once. It just seems so mundane.
So characters now earn all of their wealth in Bitcoin?
Crash at any moment in game.
Yeah.
It's run by the Church of Abadar.
Yeah, it's right. No. So I think
access your account by praying.
I think you do touch on something though, right? Which is that it's always been mildly ridiculous when it's like, oh, I've got this sword that I got and I'm high level and I just found this sword. I will trade it to you for your kingdom. It's a sword. So for us, one of the things that I kind of laid in front of the team as a challenge was, I don't want the most expensive magic item in the game to cost more than a castle. Right? It just shouldn't. I don't know what a castle needs to cost, but I do know that magic items can't be 500,000 gold pieces. That's ridiculous.
Unless it's an artifact.
That starts getting to the point where you have trouble dealing with the number. The number becomes too unwieldy to work with, and it starts to strain credulity that, like, what do you got in your belt pouch there, mister? 500,000 platinum pieces?
How many wheelbarrows of diamonds?
Yeah, exactly. So I think the big thing we did is that the base version of the game at first level is actually a silver-based economy. You start with 150 silver.
Yep.
And almost all the equipment, all the gear in the equipment chapter is listed, its price is listed in silver pieces. Because that's what you start out with, just some silver. So, you know, that first bad guy you kill that actually has a whole gold piece on him, that's pretty sweet. That's not bad. Hey, look at that, a whole gold.
The Delph offers you a 50 gold piece reward. Some of you may have played it. It's really quite good.
And well, that's because it was written before the economy changed. So, well.
Not right. No, I thought it was just supposed to be.
No, just board. Ludicrous. Yeah.
So would you say that gold futures in Galarian are?
I think you're going to want to short it. Yeah, no, we changed it a bit. The most expensive magic items in the game now are what, like 50 grand or something?
I think around 75,000.
Yeah, around 75K.
Yeah, and that makes it pretty.
For like a plus five.
That's like a plus five, 20th level item. That's really good.
Or the might
is not. Whereas before they were several hundred thousand. So we basically cut a zero off the end of it and brought the numbers down a bit to be a little closer to reality. But it still doesn't totally solve the problem of a high-level character having literally a wheelbarrow full of gold.
Yeah. We also live in a modern economy where basically currency is imaginary, right? Once upon a time, being able to buy that sword that you got for 500, you know, 1,000 gold, who's going to buy it? Who's got that much gold?
Right? You're talking about bringing inflation into it, and so you get a guy walking into town 5,000 gold.
It's an interesting question. In one of my home games, only the bad guys could afford it, so they had to make a détente so that they could sell an item to their enemies because they both wanted the other thing more.
That is the most Mark story.
That can only happen in a Mark game. All right.
I like that idea.
Let's go right here.
That's good. All right. So with the addition of the ancestries, how do you look at maybe approaching subraces? So now that you have an elven ancestry, do you look at aquatic elves as a different ancestry, or
we don't see any ancestry as subs. So
but we have a thing called heritage feats, right. Which is something you can only take at first level. So my guess, we haven't really dug too deep into this, so this isn't the final world, but my guess is there would be a heritage feat for that kind of says you're a part of the aquatic branch of this ancestry. Yeah. Because we don't really want to do like physiological changes that you can take as a fifth level feat, because that's weird.
Suddenly I grow gills.
Suddenly my skin turns purple.
Yeah.
I was hanging out on the mana wastes, and so I got to respec my racial feats. It's,
that's fair.
It's crazy.
So no, I mean, one of the things that we did is the ancestries actually open up a lot of opportunities for us to play with those rules in ways that are much more interesting than before, right? So one of the big opportunities with a new version of Pathfinder is just building new design space for ourselves. Right? If you think about it, right, you know, how many feats have we published in the past 10 years? How many spells? How many magic items, right? We've done a lot of those. That's a lot of design space. Well, we still have that design space, but with a new version of the game, we also can look at it from, like, what new rules elements can we build that then later we can build more of? Because they're fun, and they're interesting, and they're exciting. But, you know, it's all about being responsible in which, you know, which ones are worth adding to. Right, you know, and which ones are so minor or so discreet that they're not worth building a lot for, right? So that's always kind of the balance point of that sort of thing. But
and
in
also
this
figuring
case,
out where we present that. So like for the right adventure path,
yeah,
having aquatic elf might be a really compelling choice, and then we could build those into the right place.
We also need to find rules elements that broaden the game rather than narrowing it. Yeah. Like, for instance, racial flavored class bonuses that were different seemed like they would broaden the game at the time when they came out, but they really actually narrow it because, oh, well, this one's really strong for my class, and now I better play that race every time.
And a lot of that, especially in first edition, was a lot of that was problems with things that had to be very, very small and very, very narrow. So mm-hmm. things like those alternate favorite class bonuses, things like traits, where it would be, if this is slightly too good, it's the only choice now in the meta of the game. Whereas now we try to make those choices kind of bigger in concept. So like backgrounds are letting you get two ability bumps, and they're giving you a skill feat, and they're giving you a lore skill, and that's broad enough that we can play with that a lot and still have it be relatively balanced to one another, provided we, you know, maintain our discipline.
There's one. Crucially, they almost never give something that's unique that can only be gained from the background, right, so that you don't feel like, well, I'll never get it, now I better have to take that background.
Yeah, you can divide rules elements down into a discrete enough part that it's impossible to design more of them.
Yeah.
Like, I think this
but we always want to design more.
And this was the problem we had with, like, traits. Right? You know, you guys are familiar with traits, right? Yeah, those aren't in the new version of the game. We combined them, all of that rules element and background story element, into backgrounds. And we did that because it gave us enough width, enough breadth of rule space to do more interesting things. Traits were so small that it was like, oh, well, you know, it's just this tiny little micro bonus. And it was way too easy for one to be way better than the others, yeah, right? I mean, in PFS, I can't even tell you how many characters are like, what is it? It's like orphan or something?
No, beaten by their parents.
Beaten by their parents.
Reactionary. Which is actually true about Celtiel. So he got that one as an iconic because he really was beaten by his
father.
He's just, Celtiel looks like a min-maxer. Come on.
Yeah.
I want to cast spells and fight.
When your human parents give birth to a half-elf, then the father is not going to be happy. That's my story.
Oof. Oh yeah, that's gonna happen. All right, great. I mean, right here.
Yep. It's all DC Universe.
I'm running Iron Fang Invasion right now, and one of the things that was a real breath of fresh air for me as a GM, since we run a lot of your content, is that is the main population of bad guys don't use magic at all. And I found, like, from running that, I looked at a lot of the other stuff that I've run from Paizo, and in the Galarian world, magic permeates everything to the point where it has become normal. And magic is no longer a special thing, despite this being a fantasy setting. I would like to see in the new edition some thinning out of everything that, even if it is advancing, being attributed to magic. I'd love to see some things that come from advancements that come from special materials or special focuses of training or...
Well, you're in luck, because wizards can't go above third level anymore.
Sorry, Kurt. And they're black mages. Isn't that what we just said?
I think...
I mean, pulling apart alchemy from magic is part of doing that as well.
Right.
Alchemy basically a fantasy pseudoscience, mm-hmm, rather than just, you know, potions and
And that was part of it, and also pulling like spells out of paladins,
yeah,
right?
They do have spells.
They do, but they don't get them like they used to,
yeah,
right? I mean, they can get a handful of them that are level appropriate and power appropriate.
See the ranger.
What? I didn't hear anything.
Yeah. And then just kind of the same thing, like maybe having a ninth level item or something that is still mundane, magical.
Oh,
valuable at level.
So
legendary swords are like level 15 items.
What's your
legendary sword? The sword non-magical. Mm-hmm. A sword crafted by a legendary weaponsmith, one of the greatest smiths of your time. 15th level item.
Yeah, it's a 15th level item. It's non-magical, and it gets +3 on attack rolls because it's just that sharp. Like, no, expert quality weapons give you a +1. Master quality weapons give you a +2, and legendary give you a +3. Normally, that's going to be overridden by the magic bonus that's on it, but it's still, just like in the previous version of the game where masterwork was still floating around on a magic weapon, but it got overridden by the magic.
Hey, but if you're an anti-magic field, right, it's still sharp.
Plus legendary quality weapons, higher quality weapons can hold more resonance. You can put more runes on them, and you can have more powers on
them. There's so many.
There's also, like, the weapons are usually going to be beaten out by the magic version of the weapon. But if you have, like, legendary thieves tools, those are really good, because, like, even without being magical, they are very strong items.
Right, and legendary armor has a really low armor check penalty, and the pluses isn't even going to help you with that in any way.
Well, let's go up here in front.
So, spontaneous casters.
Yeah.
Always felt like they'd gotten the short shift. We don't even have a full divine caster in core now, the second edition. And I think the Oracle was a much better take on it than the Sorcerer, because you had choices at every level, whereas here's your layout, and that's it. And you were always a level behind the prepared casters, which kind of screwed you up in adventures, because they were like,
can oh, we you're spoil level, one so thing?
Third level spells.
Based on what he just said?
People know about that one.
No, just the being a level behind.
Yeah. We also thought it was not great that they were level behind. Yeah.
So they're not anymore.
You got your spells at the same time as the prepared
spells. As to a few other things, give it a few months. We'll talk. that's really all I'm going to say right now.
Yeah.
So, good insight.
Yeah, there's also
Let's
a lot more.
Talk later.
There's also a lot more going on with any of the spontaneous classes. And I'm not talking about any of them specifically here, but because of the way class feats work, you are going to have a lot more customization for any of those spontaneous
all of them do,
classes, because
yeah.
they have feats that are built specifically for them.
I also don't want to see what happened with the wizard where you got the exploiter archetype. It was like, well, I just ate the sorcerer's lunch.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about that.
Yeah.
There's a hard core rule in playtest that nobody eats anybody else's lunch.
Yeah, you write your name on that, you put it in the
lunch.
You put that in the player fridge, somebody else eats that, you get to cast just jump
shot. No more making rules elements that are actually exploits and calling them exploiter or exploits.
Yeah.
Should we see racial crafted weapons and armor, like dwarven armor or elven weapons?
Yes.
But they're more ancestral now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's something we've always played with. I actually tried to push for some of that years ago, but it never really came to fruition. It's one of those things that I think sounds cool in my head, but it does make me wonder if the value of it is just not quite there, right? The like saying, oh, what's the difference between a set of plate mail and dwarven plate mail? Well, okay, but that has to be different and interesting enough to be different than expert plate mail. Okay, well, now what happens if I take both of those and put them on a thing? Because that's going to be the next thing a player asks. And, you know, you end up with kind of a bunch of layers, a bunch of templates on top of a thing. And eventually your title for a thing of, oh, this is a +5 expert dwarven full plate. Oh, it's adamantine, and you know, and all of a sudden,
and it has 3 properties on it.
Yep.
But there's still something there. I don't know what it is, though. I want to find something with that. I just don't know what it is. Like
we have like elven chain that's just kind of sitting there on its own.
Yeah.
I feel like I suggest something, but yeah. I don't.
Right. We got that dwarf trait. We got that elf trait. We can put them on.
Yeah, we can
have them on some things.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we only got time for a little bit more. We'll go here.
So you mentioned the fixes for the illusion, which sound great. Do divinations have a similar feel so that you don't worry about your GM not being able to keep up with or screwing you over if you use something like scrying? Or...
I think that to say something that won't make sense until later when you see things, that you're not going to have to worry so much about casting divination spells that break the plot and your GM can't handle them as you did in first edition.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that's always a classic problem whenever we're doing any build. Oh, my diviner is way in the back for my home game. Yeah, we're screwing over you. That's right. Yeah. Son of a bitch.
I'm not saying we're screwing over the diviner.
No.
I'm saying we're making...
Just Ross.
Just Ross.
But we're making it easier for groups that know that they might have problems dealing with divinations or things like that to figure out what they want to do.
One of the things that we did is, I don't want to create... I want there to be answers to the problems, right? So if there are cool spells that let you spy on people, there should be cool spells that let people not spy on you, right? You know, there needs to be counterplay floating around in there, and first edition just didn't have enough of it. So it's an interesting challenge, because you don't want to overload the system with just a whole bunch of, no, you don't get to do this,
negates this and this, but this negates this, so this doesn't negate this, but this negates this, then negates this.
It's back and forth, back and forth.
So it's like, you see invisibility, fine, I'll cast a higher level invisibility then. Well, then I'll cast a higher level see invisibility. And it depends on who's willing to devote more resources into getting what they want, instead of being like, well, yeah, my second level spell stops your 19th level character from hiding with invisibility.
Wizard slap fight! let's see, we got time for, let's just call it one more, right here.
I was just wondering, I would like to see like a little bit in the exploration field, a little bit more streamlining or advice for like perception and dealing with that, and then with like traps and just slow down, or maybe how to handle like rooms and whatnot. And being fair to the players, but
Kind of like the how much can I search with this much time?
Exactly.
I think you're gonna like that. That's actually one of the key things with making exploration mode separate and naming an exploration mode, getting exploration tactics. Exactly to go through that thing, because a lot of the times we would often say, we post on the boards in Pathfinder first when someone's like, doesn't this mean I have to roll, if I'm going through a 200 foot corridor, that I have to roll one for every 5 feet, 40 checks? And we were like, no, just roll when the thing is there and see if you find it. Now it's codified in exploration mode, it's streamlined. Now it's the rule. You have to do that.
And you can't roll
40 checks.
And we also have, on the flip side of that, in an encounter, we have the seek action, which kind of defines how you try to find things in the middle of a fight. So if the invisible monster is flying around, it's like, okay, I'm going to look for it. All right, that's an action. You get to make your roll, and here are the rules.
So I think for instead of creating rules for how things work and then forcing the GM to extrapolate how they apply to situations, For this, we actually took a much more deliberative approach to say, okay, here's the rules for how those things work, but how does that work in the different phases of the game, right? And how does that make a difference? Like, the perform skill works really differently in downtime than it does in the middle of a fight. Because the orcs aren't going to throw money at you.
I mean, maybe.
I don't know. It depends how good your check is, I guess.
You actually can fascinate the orcs if you're good enough with the right skill feats.
That might be
But they're real. They're very stingy, though. It's like, oh, here's a rat skull.
I was going to kill you, but man, can that guy dance.
The only thing I can give you is an axe to pay for it, so we'll just throw
it. I'll throw my axe at you.
I mean, being fascinated just means they have to focus on you. Attacking you is focusing on you. That's true. That's the rules.
All right, everybody. I think that's going to just about wrap up this panel. I want to thank you guys all for coming. We hope you have a great PaizoCon. And for many of you, I'm sure we will see you at the banquet here in just about an hour. For the rest of you, enjoy your show. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KD Con team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.